From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And for the first time since the late 90s, all three of the major U.S. stock indexes closed at record highs on the same day yesterday. Now, the stock market is just one economic indicator, an important one, but just one. And as stocks surged, Macy's announced that it would close 100 stores across the country. Michael Regan is columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly. He joins us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with the stock market. What is going on? What is sending it to these record highs, all three indexes on the same day?
Well, yesterday, that surge, that closing of Macy's stores actually did cause their stock to surge and many other retailers as well. And that helped the market break through to those highs yesterday. But the main catalyst over the longer term this year has really been the fact that central banks in Europe and Japan have done a lot to keep the interest rates on government bonds very low and even negative in many cases. So that has sort of pushed investors into the stock market, since the steady income you can get from dividends and the possibility that the market could gain and go higher is much more appealing right now to investors than what's offered in the bond market.
So you're saying that this is just being juiced by central banks, that there's no underlying good news about the economy that's prompting people to invest in stocks?
Well, the economy is doing pretty well. The jobs growth is good. So that sort of is a tailwind to stocks as well. But as far as, you know, stocks traditionally are valued on how much profit the companies are making. And profits have been going down for several quarters in a row now, which means the valuations of the market has been going up. And that's really something that's surprising a lot of people on Wall Street. Last year, the market was basically flat for the year. And it appeared like these higher valuations were keeping things in check. But now, really, the appetite for the stock market is being driven in a large extent because bond yields are so low that the stock market is looking much more attractive.
Is there a concern that there is a bubble? As we mentioned, the last time this happened was back in 1999 during the dot-com boom, and then it went bust.
Right. The valuation of the market is very high on many metrics. You know, if you look at the prices of stocks compared to profits or sales or the value of the company's assets, it's still nothing like the days of the dot-com bubble. The S&P 500 would have to gain about another 50% to approach that. But if you want a sense of how overvalued or richly valued it is, Doug Ramsey, a strategist at a firm called Luthold Group in Minneapolis, had a report out saying, and he looked at a bunch of different valuation metrics. And he said if they were all to just revert to their mean overnight, it would be about a 22% drop in the stock market. Now, there's nothing to say that they will have to do that, that, you know, mean reversion will absolutely take place at least anytime soon. But it is something that concerns a lot of people.
Well, and by the way, our weekly guest, Jill Schlesinger from CBS News, who is a financial planner as well as talking to us, would always say, don't make a decision about your own stocks based on what's happening right now. Just rebalance every 6 months or so. So anyway, the big picture there from Jill. But we did talk about Macy's, Mike, and closing 100 stores. What's going on with Macy's?
Basically, sales at Macy's have been declining. So the company decided to shut down some of the underperforming stores and retrench a little bit. And that's good news to investors in the stock. And that's the stock shot up about 17% yesterday. The main problem for Macy's is that traffic at malls has been very sluggish, and the dollar has been strong versus other major currency. And so that has a noticeable effect on the spending from overseas tourists when they come to visit the United States. So sort of many problems confronting Macy's, and the closure of the stores was viewed as a good choice by them to sort of retrench and get out of the less profitable locations.
So this is just a Macy's issue. It's not about broader retail, because we did see from the Commerce Department today that retail sales in July were flat.
Department stores basically across the board are facing this similar struggle, mainly because of companies like Amazon.com and other internet e-commerce companies. As far as the overall retail sales number, there's a lot that goes into that report. Gas station sales were down pretty big because simply gas prices were a lot lower in the month. But basically, one of the other big headwinds is that income growth has never been very robust in this economic expansion after the recession, and it's really been trending down this year. So people simply aren't making a lot more money and therefore not spending a lot more than they did in the previous months and quarters.
That's Mike Regan, columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly, talking with us about retail and the stock market at a record yesterday. Mike, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, as Mike just said, stocks are booming. So is the amount of natural gas produced by fracking in the eastern U.S. And that's led to a big push to build new pipelines to move the gas between states. And pipeline companies can route their lines through people's land using the power of eminent domain if it's considered in the public interest. But what happens when the pipelines are carrying the byproducts of natural gas production, liquids like propane, butane, or ethane? Julie Grant of Here and Now contributor, The Allegheny Front, found out.
The quiet hills of eastern Ohio and Harrison County have become a popular spot, and not just for the cicadas you hear, but also for oil and gas development. Mick Luber grows tomatoes, greens, even fava beans here at his organic farm and sells them at local markets in Pittsburgh. He says recent years have brought a compressor station and multiple well sites so close they wake him up at night.
For the first year that they were fracking, it was hard for me to go outside. I felt so bad hearing the roar of all this stuff. It's nice to have the cicadas that drown them out.
Now pipeline companies like Kinder Morgan are knocking on Luber's door.
They wanted to come right down through this main field and go up over top of that hill. There's a spring right up there. That's the most fertile part of this farm.
Another company, Marathon, made a deal with Luber's neighbor and is already building a pipeline on the southern border of his 65-acre farm. Luber points up the valley where pipes are lined up, waiting to be connected. The ground has been stripped bare.
This is what you end up with. This was all woods.
Shell is also planning a line here. So when Kinder Morgan showed up, Luber said no. No pipeline, not even a survey.
I told him I didn't want it.
Kinder Morgan sued. One of the main arguments in Luber's defense, the contents of Kinder Morgan's pipeline. Not natural gas for home heating, but ethane to make plastics for the Canadian company Nova Chemicals. Ethane, along with propane and butane, are known as natural gas liquids. They're byproducts of natural gas that's being fracked in the region. Increasingly, landowners are arguing that they shouldn't have to give up their property rights for companies to transport these liquids to make plastics, especially if they're being sent to other countries. Kinder Morgan spokesperson Ellen Foer says, yes, they should. Plastics are in the public interest.
You tell me anybody in this country that doesn't use plastics in some way and that plastics aren't critically important to their everyday lives, from cups to medical devices, to automobiles.
If this were a natural gas pipeline, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, would also have authority over setting its route. But what about a pipeline transporting liquids like ethane?
FERC has no authority to regulate natural gas liquids in the United States at all. FERC's authority is strictly limited to natural gas.
Attorney Rich Raiders represents about a dozen landowners in Pennsylvania against eminent domain action from a different pipeline company, Sunoco Logistics. He says when FERC has authority, as it does for siting natural gas pipelines, landowners have a say in the route.
That's an all public, eyes open discussion, whereas for natural gas liquid line, that's between the individual landowner and the pipeline operator, and no government entity is involved at all.
So when it comes to eminent domain for pipelines carrying natural gas liquids, that's being decided in state courts. In Kentucky, landowners recently won a victory when a court said a pipeline company couldn't take their property for a natural gas liquids pipeline. But in July, in Pennsylvania, an appellate court agreed with Sunoco, supporting its power to take land in all 17 counties along the path of a controversial pipeline. In an email, Sunoco said it's come to agreement with the majority of landowners. At least one landowner in Harrison County, Ohio, where Sunoco's pipeline begins, is fighting the company's eminent domain action. Nicholas Anderson is the landowner's lawyer.
The bottom line is that when they're approaching landowners in Ohio, they have this big stick called eminent domain. And so they say, look, we'll give you X number of dollars per linear foot, but if you don't accept that, we're just going to take your property. And that is where we have a problem.
Anderson's Ohio clients lost their court case against Sunoco, but they're appealing. He says that Kinder Morgan, the company farmer Mick Luber was fighting, recently filed 130 eminent domain cases to take land for their ethane pipeline in at least 8 Ohio counties. Kinder Morgan spokesperson Alan Fore says they only take eminent domain action as a last resort.
If you look at our route, you can see a lot of zigs and zags and turns, certainly not a straight line. Those are all based upon big issues like avoiding environmentally sensitive areas or individual landowner concerns.
Like Mick Luber's, Kinder Morgan recently announced they would reroute around his farm. Still, Luber doesn't see it as a victory.
Well, as long as these guys are still doing this stuff, what is the victory, you know? You can't stop the vigilance, you know? People got to keep standing in their way.
Kinder Morgan says Luber got what he wanted, but the company wants it clear. It can't reroute its pipelines for every landowner who has a problem with them. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant in Ohio.
Tall and thin and young and lovely, the gal from Ipanema goes walking and...
Antonio Carlos Jobim's 1964 hit Girl from Ipanema was reborn at the opening ceremonies of the Olympics as model Gisele Bündchen strode across the arena. Spotify reports the song spiked to 40,000 streams a day.
That when she passes, each one she passes goes.
So we thought, what about hearing some other great Brazilian music? The first time I heard Milton Nascimento, I think I swooned. Like many of the Brazilian legends, Milton's music spans generations. Brazilians of all ages know the words to songs from him, Gilberto Gil, Caetano Veloso. Some of the greats were exiled during the country's military dictatorship, 1964 to 1985, and returned to triumphant welcome. So let's hear more of the old and the new with Beto Arcos, host of the podcast The Cosmic Barrio. He's at NPR West. Hi, Beto.
My pleasure to be with you, Robin.
Let's take another second on Milton. I know you want us to hear new voices, but it's hard to explain what a giant he is among the giants in Brazil. Tell us more about him.
Well, he comes from the state of Minas Gerais. He came of age in the 1960s. They used to do these sort of variety shows, TV shows, and competitions for songs. And his presence was very, very strong when he came on those television programs and competitions. And that's where his career really took off in the late 60s and early 70s.
And then he had the song Maria Marita, which became an anthem. Let's listen. It just makes you want to bounce. I mean, in fact, I hear he say, I've heard him say he was influenced by the Beatles. But you want to take us to other Brazilian music essentials.
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that Brazil has many musical styles. I think it's important to, as well, to understand that that one of the most important music that perhaps is known to everyone because of Carnival is samba, because samba is the vehicle through which Brazilians express everything, their pains, their happiness, their joys, their difficulties. And there are many different styles of samba. And I want to bring to your attention a singer that was sort of the main singer of the Escola de Samba Mangueira, one of the great samba schools in Brazil. His name is Jamelão. And here is a song called Recordações do Rio Antigo, which means remembrances of old Rio.
Let's listen.
Rio, cidade tradicional. Daí
so we can feel ourselves moving to the one step forward, one step back. We know it's a samba. Beto Arcos, as you said, there's so many, so we want to get to the next. Bossa Nova.
You know, we could have half a dozen names in the mix, but I thought I'd bring some a group of four women singers from Bahia who were sort of noticed by the great Vinicius de Moraes, one of the great lyricists of Bossa Nova. The group is called Quarteto MC, and I want to, you know, share a tune by Vinicius de Moraes called Canto de Ossanha. Ossanha is one of the deities of the religion known as Candomblé, and this is sort of Vinicius de Moraes taking that idea and bringing it to this incredibly high level.
O homem que de sol não é, porque quem é mesmo é, não sou. O homem que de estou não tá, porque ninguém tá quando quer. Coitado do homem que cai, no canto de Ossanha traidor. Coitado do homem que vai, atrás de mandinga de amor.
Ah, the blend is wonderful. But we move on to Chico Buarque.
Chico Buarque.
Yeah.
Chico Buarque, in my humble opinion, is the songwriter of Brazil, particularly in this song called O Meu Guri, which means My Little Kid. It's a story of a kid from the favela, from the poor neighborhood, who turns into, unfortunately, a criminal. Mm. But this is written from the perspective of his mother. It's a most incredible story. Let's listen.
Eu consolo ele, ele me consola. Boto ele no colo pra ele, menina. De repente acordo, olho pro lado. O danado já foi trabalhar. Olha aí, olha aí. Ai, ai, o meu guri, olha aí. Olha aí.
Oh, by the way, we're going to have a list of all of Beto Arcos' picks for Brazilian music at hearnow.org. But I know you want us to hear Luiz Gonzaga.
Luiz Gonzaga, another tower of songwriting from the northeastern part of Brazil, from the desert-like kind of a climate where many hundreds, thousands, millions of people migrated from the northeast of Brazil to the cities, to Rio, to São Paulo, in search of a better life. And this song called Asa Branca, White Dove, is in a sense their anthem.
Quando eu ia a terra ardendo, qual fogueira de São João, eu perguntei a Deus do céu, ai, por que tamanha judiação?
Well, as we know from watching the opening ceremonies, and as heard, you know, Brazilians absorb every form of music and make it their own, and they have a lot of new voices, new styles. Let's listen to some of the newer, including the youngest daughter of Antonio Carlos Jobim.
That's right. Her name is Maria Luisa Jobim. She is, as you said, the youngest daughter of Jobim, one of the towers of music of Brazil. But what you're going to hear is something completely different. It's not bossa nova. It's not samba. It's something else. And this is the group that she's a part of, Opala. She sings this song that there's no translation for it. I think it's sort of a made-up word. It's called Maracajaisu.
Maracajaisu.
It's beautiful. And with the name Jobim, no pressure there.
That's right.
He's a god in Brazil. We also want to hear a different sound, maybe, than people might expect from Brazil.
That's right. Yeah. For a long time, really, Brazil has always been open to all kinds of music. You mentioned earlier Milton Nascimento, influenced by the Beatles. Well, wouldn't you know it, in the last decade or so, there's been an interest in African music, specifically Afrobeat, which was created by the great Fela Kuti in Nigeria in the early 70s. But this is their own take on Afrobeat. It's Brazilian Afrobeat with a singer named Otto. This is a band called the Abayomi Afrobeat Orchestra, and the song is called World Without Memory.
É preciso acordar, ver o que é lá fora.
Beto Arcos, you have something more for us.
Well, this is an album that was reissued a couple of decades ago. It's an album of João Gilberto. It's actually a CD that has two albums that were released in the mid to late 70s. I want to share a piece that's in the album called Amoroso, where you have João Gilberto at the top of his game with a classic tune by none other than Antônio Carlos Jobim, and the arrangements with strings by the great German arranger Klaus Ogerman. This is called Triste, or Sad.
Sua beleza é avião. Demais para pobre coração. Que parar pra te ver passar só pra me maltratar. Triste é viver na solidão.
We're walking on a beach.
Oh, yeah.
with a musical tour through Brazil with Beto Arcos, host of the podcast The Cosmic Barrio. We'll have all of the songs he suggested, plus a few more we'll throw in at herenow.org. Beto, thank you so much. Obrigado.
Prazer, muito prazer.
Veneza, Veneza.
Oh, my heart. We just had two more of Milton Nascimento, and we'll have this whole album at herenow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping you make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at Blue Apron. blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
And there was quite a show in the sky last night, if you had a clear view. Lots of shooting stars thanks to the Perseid meteor shower, which is especially dramatic this year. The dusty tail of a comet is striking the Earth's atmosphere, sending streaks of light across the night sky. Brian Mann of Here and Now contributor North Country Public Radio climbed a summit in New York's Adirondack Mountains last night to get a great view.
I am climbing through pitch blackness. Wherever my headlamp isn't pointing, it just falls away into absolute inky darkness. A little bit spooky.
This is Owl's Head, just outside Lake Placid, New York. I scramble up over rocks, catching glimpses of a half moon. There are steep cliffs on both sides of the trail. I have to be careful here.
Wow. I have come to the first break in the trees, and I can see moon-silhouetted mountains. And stars and gauzy clouds. Welcome breeze kind of moving the trees here. There's a smell of pine and cicadas making that pure summer sound.
At the crown of rock on top of Owl's Head, I make a little camp. The moon sets after midnight and the sky turns even darker. I sit up to watch.
I've just seen my first really bright flash. Oh yeah, there. Again.
For the next couple of hours, I sleep a little, then watch a little, catching glimpses of quick sparks.
Oh, the sky has really cleared now, and the Milky Way is beautiful. You can see actual currents in it, kind of little dark and light patches.
I lie there a long time, surprised over and over by fresh eruptions of comet dust. The flashes are fast as a reflex. But this colloquy of mountain rock and forest and falling light has been going on for ages. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Mann in New York's Adirondack Mountains.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm jealous. And NPR science reporter Nell Greenfield-Boyce also got to see the Perseids last night. Nell, were they everything you had hoped for?
Well, you know, you always want to see meteors streaming down out of the sky like the stars are falling on you, and it wasn't quite like that. But it was pretty cool. I saw a couple dozen, everything from little lines of light to, you know, sort of bigger fireballs.
And if you missed them last night, is there still time to see the Perseids?
Absolutely. Last night was the peak, but you can definitely still see some tonight if you can get somewhere dark and give yourself some time. You know, a lot of times people look up at the sky and after 15 minutes they say, hey, you know, I didn't see anything. This is a bust. You know, what's going on? What you really need to do is get yourself somewhere dark and lie there and just look up at the sky. Let your eyes adjust. You know, don't keep looking at your phone every 5 minutes. You know, you need to just stare at the sky for like 45 minutes, preferably between midnight and dawn, because that's when the viewing is best, because the moon will set and it'll get nice and dark.
And any particular part of the sky you should look at?
You know, they say you can look at certain parts of the sky, but I mean, I find that the best thing to do is just to sort of let your eyes sort of gaze over the whole sky, and they'll come from all over the place.
That's NPR science reporter Nell Greenfield-Boyce. Nell, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here's a headline that caught our eye this week. It's about swimmer Michael Phelps winning another medal, but it's directed at his partner. Congrats, girl. Fiancé of former Miss California scoops his 25th medal. The article at the news site The Tablet is a satirical look at what it would sound like if Phelps and his fiancé, Nicole Johnson, were discussed in the same way the female Olympians are. Here's another line. His black swim cap accentuated his statuesque features. He completed the look with stylish but functional wraparound goggles. Earlier this week, when Hungarian swimmer Katinka Hasu broke a world record in the 400-meter medley, NBC commentator Dan Hicks said her husband, cheering poolside, was the man responsible. Really? When trap shooter Corey Cogdell-Unrein won her medal, the Chicago Tribune tweeted, "Wife of a Bears lineman wins a bronze." Dana Hooper is a sports agent in Arizona who works with several female Olympic athletes. Dana, this is jumping out at a lot of people. You say you see it all the time.
I do. I think that with female athletics, it's often compared to not only men, but also to their husbands if they are married, or their spouses, in some instances, are also sometimes women themselves. It is unusual that in this kind of a extremely well-covered era of social media, it is actually unusual to have this topic. But it's become popular because of the Olympics and some of the commentary that's been referenced about the Hungarian swimmer and the husband. It's something that I scratch my head about only because, as you mentioned, the women are the ones getting up every morning and, you know, every evening staying up late in their competitions.
Right. They're the ones that are actually doing it. And why is this important other than it might frustrate women athletes? Why else is it important?
I think it sets female athletes back. In the 1990s, the Olympic committees, both the international and individual countries, put a focus on getting more female athletes out there, giving more opportunities for female athletes. Since the 1990s, it's grown quite significantly. In fact, for the United States, the athletes are 53% women this year, which is quite a feat considering years ago it was very imbalanced the other way. The women work just as hard as the men, and they both deserve the accolades that they're getting. I'm not sure why there's a constant comparison other than the women often in other countries, in addition to the United States, trying to catch up with salaries and media attention and ticket sales and all of that. But it's important because if we continue to have the media make comments that are somewhat, and in some cases, very derogatory towards women, we're going back in history. We need to move forward.
Well, and it might have an impact on things like wages and salaries. I mean, we remember that during the Women's World Cup last year, the top players in women's soccer were suing for wage discrimination. And there are those who think that if you are not characterized as a real athlete, if you're characterized as some, you know, little lady who had to be helped along by your coach or by your boyfriend, then you also won't be paid accordingly. I mean, do you agree that that does damage when they sit down and sign a contract?
Well, when they sit down and sign a contract, presumably they are before a general manager or an owner that has taken interest in women's sports. You would hope that they would be part of the catalyst for bringing equality to women's sports. However, that's not always the case. And the ownership and the folks that are going to be paying the salaries of these female athletes, in addition to the sponsors, they have to look at the metrics. If they feel like there are not enough ticket sales or jersey sales or commercial interest in these individual athletes as women, then that's a problem. And, you know, is it the more beautiful women get the sponsorships? Absolutely. I would be disingenuous to sit here and say that, you know, when I'm approached for sponsorship for the athletes I represent, they are oftentimes looking for people with a certain look. That is not the same for my male athletes.
No.
It is something that is a factor in society.
That's sports agent Dana Hooper. Dana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, two athletes who compete on their own merits will participate in the men's decathlon and the women's heptathlon as track and field starts. The decathlon is 10 events, the heptathlon 7, running, jumping, throwing. The decathlon's roots stretch back to ancient Greece, and today it's dominated by American Ashton Eaton. Here he is at the 2015 World Championships in the 400 meters.
Oh, my word, 45 dead. It's a personal best for Ashton Eaton.
And 45-10, that run helped Eaton set a world record for decathlon points. He's the overwhelming favorite to win in Rio, just as he did in London. But he's just half our story.
Nice run in the opening event of the heptathlon for Breanne Tyson-Eaton, who has to be happy.
Breanne Tyson-Eaton, she finished second in the World Championships last year. She might win gold as well. Oh, and yeah, Ashton is married to her. David Willey is editor-in-chief at Runner's World. David, start with Ashton Eaton. How good is he?
Well, the world's greatest athlete, right? Which is what the decathlete champion has been known as for a long, long time. And he is the world record holder. He is the defending Olympic champion. And he's won four consecutive world championships since the London Games. So he'd be the first to tell you that he's not a guarantee to win the gold medal, but he is far and away the leading favorite.
Well, to put into perspective how good he is, you can think of then Bruce Jenner. Now, of course, she is Caitlyn Jenner, but just that great an athlete. Why isn't he better known, though, the way Bruce Jenner was?
Well, that's a great question. I think the world just has gotten more complicated since, you know, the 70s when Bruce Jenner was competing, you know. And track and field certainly is still a popular sport, but other sports have become so much more popular worldwide.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to imagine even somebody being on the box of Wheaties as Bruce Jenner was after he won the gold, even really registering that much in our culture
right
today. So I think that's as much of a reason as anything. But believe me, Ashton Eaton is every bit superlative an athlete as Bruce Jenner was in his day.
Well, and then there's his wife, Breanne. They met at the University of Oregon, where there is obviously something in the water that grows runners. but she's from Canada, so she competes for Canada, has never won an Olympic medal. Can she, you know, is she really a contender in the heptathlon in Rio?
She absolutely is. She's on the rise. She didn't have a great London Olympics. She finished 10th. But since then, she's done very well in the World Championships and recently won first place in the most recent indoor World Championships, where Ashton did as well, quite the power couple. And the defending Olympic champ is Britain's Jessica Ennis-Hill, a superb athlete, but she's had a bit of an injury-plagued season. She's already said that these will be her last Olympics, so it feels like she might be a little bit on the downside of her career. Another factor is going to be, at the past two Olympics, a Russian named Tatiana Chernova won bronze in both 2012 and 2008. She, of course, has been banned from these Olympics in Rio, like the entire Russian track and field team, with one exception, a long jumper. Yeah. So, you know, that's another key competitor that will not be in the picture for Breanne, and she's got a real shot.
Well, you mentioned that Breanne and her husband Ashton are a power couple. But they put their power, you know, their power isn't in Hollywood. They put it into humanitarian work. In their spare time, they like to go to Kenya and help villages get water. Maybe one of the reasons that, you know, they're not household names. But just tell us, how do we watch? You know, how do we watch these events?
Oh, it's fascinating to watch. And it's a little harder to get this on television. But I was actually at the Olympic track and field trials in Eugene, and I watched the decathlon. And it's fascinating because it's a two-day event, right? So it's broken up over a couple of days. It's incredibly grueling. They have to not only excel in the individual disciplines themselves, but they have to be able to put it together over such a long period of time. And there's a real brotherhood, and in the sense of the heptathlon, a sisterhood. These athletes, because they're not competing against each other, they're really competing against the historical standards. They're trying to accumulate as many points as they can. So you see them really rooting for each other and an incredible sense of togetherness, even after the competitions are over. Mm. But what you do want to look for, especially with Ashton and Brianne, they both excel in the running event. So you're going to see them try and build as much of a lead as they can in those running events and then try to sort of hang on in the throwing events, you know, throwing the discus, throwing the shot put. There are other athletes that excel in those other events. They tend to be bigger, you know, bulkier, mm-hmm. bigger in the shoulders, but they cannot keep up with these athletes on the track, especially in the long distance events that finish up. The 1500 meters is what the men's decathlon always ends with, and it's so grueling because they're so exhausted. Ashton will dominate that event and probably at that point be running away with the decathlon again.
Well, we'll be watching. David Willey, editor-in-chief at Runner's World, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
There are now 87 days left until Election Day, and we've been talking a lot about the presidential race, but there are also some tight Senate and House races, which brings us to this week's District Profile. In our weekly look at House races around the country, we are looking today at Iowa's 3rd District, where first-term Republican David Young is facing a challenge from Democrat Jim Maurer. O.K. Henderson is news director at Radio Iowa. She joins us. Kay, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, describe this district for us.
Well, it has two of Iowa's major metros, Des Moines and the growing suburbs to the west and south of the capital city, as well as Council Bluffs. And that, of course, is the Iowa half of the Omaha metro. But it covers 16 counties. It has the state's largest county and the state's smallest county. Hmm. In 2012, President Obama won this district.
And the candidates in this district, as we mentioned, David Young is the Republican incumbent. Here's a recent ad from him.
His story is pure Iowa. David Young, a sixth-generation Iowan from Van Meter. He walked beans, had a paper route, and worked summers at the state fair. David has dedicated his life to serving others, helping Iowans. In Congress, David is working to control spending, make Washington accountable to the people, create jobs, and keep our families safe.
I'm not exactly sure, but I think that's the first not negative ad I've heard this entire campaign season. Well, tell us about David Young and what his record has been like in the first term.
David Young used to be Senator Chuck Grassley's chief of staff. He quit that job in 2013 and started to run for the U.S. Senate, then switched to running for this congressional district because the longtime Republican incumbent who had held this district decided to retire. He won with 53% of the vote. That's sort of how this district is performing. It's considered a toss-up by those rating agencies like Cook and Sabato. And it also is considered by the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee to be a pickup opportunity, particularly because this is a candidate in David Young who is seeking re-election for the first time.
And has David Young endorsed Donald Trump?
He has said he will vote for Donald Trump. David Young did not attend the GOP convention in Cleveland, and Trump campaigned in this district last Friday. Young did not attend that rally.
Hmm. Well, his opponent is Democrat Jim Maurer, who has been trying to tie David Young to Donald Trump. But in a recent ad, Maurer actually used language very similar to Trump's campaign tagline, Make America Great Again. Maurer asked, what's it going to take to make America work again? And then he described his vision for the country. Let's listen.
I believe in the get up and get it done America, the stand up and be counted America, the ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do to serve your country, America. It's why I served in Iraq with the Iowa National Guard, and it's how I'll serve you in Congress. Country first, people first, politics last.
Wow, that makes two positive ads this campaign season. Is that just Iowa nice, or what's are they usually a little more vicious than this?
Well, this is an interesting district. It has a voter registration edge for Republicans, but not by much. There are about 161,000 registered Democrats as of August 1st, 172,000 registered Republicans. Hmm. But independents account for about 154,000 of the potential voters in this district. And they are both gunning, if you will, for those independent voters who tend to make the big difference in this particular district.
And is the fact that Jim Maurer is a veteran, and we heard about that in his ad there, going to play a big role in this race?
He emphasizes that a lot. And he is not an unfamiliar name to Iowa voters. In 2014, he challenged longtime Republican incumbent Congressman Steve King in the Northwest Congressional District in Iowa. He sort of earned Iowa Democrats' respect for stepping up and doing that. After that race, he moved to the capital city of Iowa, Des Moines, into this new district, and is now actually running for Congress for the second time, but in a different district.
Is there a lot of outside money coming into this race?
It doesn't appear to be at this point. The American Wind Action Pack is running radio ads right now on behalf of David Young, but there have not been a lot of other ads running. Of course, Hillary Clinton is running ads in Iowa because this is a toss-up state in the presidential election, and there doesn't appear to be a lot of other campaign advertising on the airwaves right now.
And is Jim Maurer tying himself to Hillary Clinton or standing at a distance?
Well, he actually stood on the same stage as Hillary Clinton when she campaigned in Des Moines. So he is obviously trying to ally himself with the Clinton campaign. Iowa Democrats run what's considered a coordinated campaign. So congressional candidates participate in the voter registration and turnout efforts along with the presidential candidates in Iowa and all the other candidates up and down the ticket.
That's O.K. Henderson, news director at Radio Iowa, talking with us about Iowa's third congressional district, the race there between Republican incumbent David Young and Democrat Jim Maurer. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And, of course, it's also going to be interesting to watch what happens in the presidential race in Iowa. Both of the candidates have been in the state in the last week, and the state fair is going on right now. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.